Second case for argument this morning is Lees against Carthage College. Ms. Tindall.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Susan Tindall, and I represent the plaintiff, Catherine Lees. This is the second appeal in this case. In the first appeal, this Court reversed the summary judgment in favor of Carthage College and held that the plaintiff's expert could testify as to Carthage's failure to meet the standard of care with regard to security on campus, particularly in the dorms. In its decision, this Court held that a triable issue of fact was raised by Dr. Kennedy's testimony as to security on Carthage's campus. Following the remand, this court held the district court held a scheduling conference and set the case for trial. The district court inquired whether any particular deadlines were requested. The defense requested some time for some additional discovery, but no other deadlines were requested, and the case was set for trial with pretrial deadlines such as motions in limine set. Shortly thereafter, the defense filed a second motion for summary judgment. We opposed that motion for summary judgment on the grounds that this court's decision was the law of the case, and with respect to whether Dr. Kennedy's testimony raised an issue of fact for trial, implicitly decided that there was sufficient evidence of causation to get to a jury.
Causation wasn't before us when the case was last here. It was strictly an admissibility question, and there was an embedded standard of care issue as well, because that had some import to the admissibility question, but causation wasn't before us.
Causation was not a direct issue in the case. It was raised in the defendant's brief, as we provided a copy of the particular page in our appendix. And it was also discussed somewhat at oral argument as well. And although it wasn't directly addressed, law of the case includes both express and implied decisions of this court or the appellate court. And in our view, given this court's policy against piecemeal appeals and the ability to affirm a district court decision on different grounds, had this court believed that there was no evidence sufficient to prove causation, there would have been no reason for this court to send this back down. It would be inefficient to send it back down and remand it just for another summary judgment motion. Given that this issue was raised and the court concluded that there was a triable issue of fact, it's our contention that it's implicit that there's sufficient evidence of causation for trial. Even if the court concludes that causation was not part of the law of the case and that causation should have been considered anew, it's our contention that the district court's decision on causation was erroneous. In its first decision, this court compared this case to a medical malpractice case, stating that it was a professional negligence case. And if you look at the requirements for causation in a medical negligence case, as in the Ellinger case, which we cited, the court has held that Wisconsin courts have held that there is no requirement that there be any specific quantum of evidence produced to show causation, but merely that the defendant or that the plaintiff provide enough evidence that there can be an inference sufficient for causation at trial. And I think the Ellinger case is significant. In that particular case, the plaintiff was pregnant with twins, but the doctor didn't diagnose the pregnancy with twins. They just thought it was a normal pregnancy. And twin pregnancies can lead to a higher risk of complications, which happened in that particular case. The defendant argued that there was insufficient evidence of causation, that if the doctor had diagnosed the twin pregnancy, that something could have been done to prevent the injuries that occurred to the twins later. And there, on pages 13 and 14 of the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, the court said, to satisfy the burden of production on causation, a plaintiff need only show that the omitted treatment was intended to prevent the very type of harm which resulted, that the plaintiff would have submitted to the treatment, and it's more probable than not that the treatment could have lessened or avoided the harm. And applying that analysis to this case, the swiping key cards, the lock on the basement door, the prop alarm on the basement door, all of those things, the experts testified, were intended to prevent the very
harm. But the only part of the expert's testimony that is admissible has to do with the prop alarm. The unsecured door. That was the import of our earlier decision in this case. So what quantum of evidence is there, if any at all, on causation with respect to the lack of a prop alarm?
Well, our expert did testify that he thought it was probable that the defendant, that the assailants came in through the basement door.
Is there any evidence to support that?
No, and he agrees. He said it was probable that they came through either that basement door or the front door.
What was the basis for the... Well, they came either through... They came through a door as opposed to coming through a window.
Correct.
Yeah, but what would be the basis for thinking that it was probable they came through a propped open back door?
Well, he said it was probable they came through either the propped open back door or the front door.
Yes, but that's... Since we're asking what basis was there for thinking they came through the back door, that was the theory of negligence that the expert's report can support. Is there any basis for thinking they came through the back door? Was there, for example, testimony that people had seen the back door propped open that evening?
No, there's no testimony that the door was seen propped open that evening, but our contention was that...
Was there any other basis for believing it had been propped open that evening?
Well,
was there a forensic study of the door, for example?
No, because...
Was there a check for fingerprints on the door? Any effort to figure out what the most recent use of the door was?
Well, there was no way to tell that because the door wasn't wired to be able to tell that kind of thing. There were no cameras.
You don't get fingerprints by wires.
Correct.
But you might check to see whether from, not necessarily fingerprints, but from finger oils, what the most recent use of that door had been.
Well, by the
Did you try to do that? That's the question.
By the time this was reported and the expert was hired, it was...
The answer to my question is either yes or no. You did try to do it or you didn't try to do it.
No.
Did you try to do it?
No.
Okay. Was there any other effort to show that the door had been propped open? That's antecedent to the question whether it was used by the rapist.
We were showing that there was evidence the door has been propped open on occasion, and there is evidence that the door was not checked. But because the door was not checked,
well,
there's no one can say that it was open or not open.
That's sort of like saying that there was evidence that the defendant in a tort case drove in excess of the speed limit on occasion, and therefore a particular accident must have been caused by his driving in excess of the speed limit. That would be a non sequitur.
This, in my view, is more akin to the doctor failing to diagnose the twin pregnancy, and then because it was not diagnosed, being unable to prevent the harm that occurred. Here there's a reason for these locks, and for the swipe cards, it's our contention that the fact that the students were not required to individually swipe in, which there is evidence of.
Was there any evidence that students entered without swiping on the night in question?
We can't tell that because there was nobody monitoring the lobby, and there was no requirement.
I take it the swipes are recorded, right?
If they
swipe. So you can tell which students swiped in. then you could ask those students, did anybody else enter at the same time you did? Was that done?
I understand that.
The answer is yes or no. Was it done?
That was not done that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I know that they did, Carthage said they did run the swipes to see who swiped in or out.
Right, but no effort was made to ask those students if somebody else entered with them.
No.
Okay.
How much time was between the time she was attacked versus the time she reported it?
6 days. She first reported it to her mother. And then
her mother did?
Her mother called the college. I believe she reported it to her mother at night, and her mother called the college the next day.
Okay, so it's about a week goes by with nobody knowing anything other than Lee's.
That's correct.
So all of this stuff about propped open door and entry and whether or not other people can walk in when a card is swiped, or maybe they did that night. This is, I think it was around midnight, a little after when this occurred.
And yes, it was after.
And isn't it about 2 a.m. when no one but residents can enter?
That's correct.
On a Saturday night. So these people that came in were wearing some kind of garb that identified Carthage. Whether everybody wears that kind of thing or whether people wear it as a disguise so they can get in, we don't know.
We don't know. And too much time had passed to tell many of these things. In our view, given the testimony with regard to the prop door and also the lack of requirement that students swipe in individually, there's sufficient evidence that the doors were improperly or negligently maintained, that the locking systems were negligently maintained, such that there is sufficient evidence to get to a jury trial on this issue. And that brings me to another component of this, is the argument that Dr. Kennedy is only allowed to testify as to the prop door. The court did say that he could testify as to the standards by the Campus Law Enforcement Administrators Association and with regard to Carthage's deviation from those standards as it impacted his opinion on the standard of care.
Well, that's a pretty long list, isn't it? Standards? So what you're trying to say is everything then would be open for additional evidence.
Well, to the extent that he relied on those standards in formulating a standard of care, this court did say that that was an appropriate thing for him to do, and it's our contention that, for example, the key card swiping is something that's in the standards, and the way that the college should have monitored that, we believe he should be able to testify to based on this court's discussion of how those standards can be applied in this particular case. But even if he could not, it's our contention that no expert testimony is needed on that particular point. Whether or not a college should install swipe readers on a door and keep the doors locked all the time, as Carthage says it does, is a matter for expert testimony. But in terms of whether a college or anyone who keeps a locked door with a card reader should insist that the card reader be used by each person coming in, we feel that that's sufficiently within the scope of an ordinary person's knowledge. Everyone is required to swipe into places these days, and it clearly defeats the purpose of having the swipe if everybody can just open the door and let crowds in, and that's what was there is testimony that occurred at Carthage. I see I'm cutting into my rebuttal time, and so I will save the remainder of my remarks unless there's additional questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Stavitt.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Ron Stadler, and I represent Carthage College. This case itself really turns upon a statement made by the appellant, page 9 of her reply brief. There, the appellant says, there's no definitive evidence as to where the assailants gained entry to the residence hall on the night in question. and that ties directly to the cause issue and supports the district court's determination that the appellant here could not show causation. It's critical, and the court has already hit upon some of these points, because there was no evidence in regard to that door having been propped open the night of the assault, the day before the assault, the day after the assault. No evidence at all. It was pure speculation on Dr. Kennedy's part as to whether that door was involved at all. There's absolutely just nothing in the record to support that issue. This court made a decision that Dr. Kennedy could offer an opinion, an expert opinion, that a prop alarm should be on that door. That's accepted. That's the law of the case. That's his opinion. But the district court properly concluded that there simply wasn't any evidence that would allow a jury to be able to say that the absence of that prop alarm was a cause of the assault. It would result in pure speculation and guesswork by the jury in order to get to that issue. When we talk about the issue of causation, I think it's that speculation part that really turns this whole case. It could be that without that prop alarm, somebody could prop a door open and somebody could walk in that door. But as I said, nothing in the record to indicate that that happened or that door was open. It also could be that these two assailants were two fellow students who possessed ID cards who could have swiped the door.
Well, I thought this was an all-girls dorm.
It is an all-female dorm. All students on the campus are allowed to be in the dorm until 2 a.m. on the weekends. So whether they're male or female, they're allowed in the dorm, and their card will allow them to swipe in until 2 a.m. in the morning.
So a male, obviously not a resident of that hallway, his card would be able to swipe in? A male student that he's a student, he's got a swipe card, works in his dorm, and apparently that one as well before 2 a.m.?
Correct. That male student goes to the female dormitory at 1 in the morning, swipes his card in, the computer recognizes him and allows him to enter. If he comes back at 2:45 in the morning and swipes his card, it doesn't allow him in, and in fact it sends a report back to the computer that somebody tried to make an unauthorized swipe at that point in time. So whether they're male or female, anybody could be in that dorm as long as they were an authorized student at that time until 2 in the morning on the weekends. And Ms. Lees testified that she knew that all other students were allowed into her dormitory until 2 a.m. on that night in question.
And so she was following some kind of a tradition of leaving her room door open?
Well, that's at least an allegation that she was following that tradition. The theory from the appellant on that is that there was this camaraderie thing at the beginning of the year, leave your door open to get to know your fellow students and you guys can all chat when people are walking about in the hallway. Her testimony about the night in question is nobody else was around. Nobody was there. So it would seem to be a disconnect that you would have your door open to chat with people walking in the hallway when there's nobody that was there.
Was her door open?
Her door was open. And in fact, her door was open. These two men came to her room, came into her doorway, and said something to her. Ms. Lees is deaf, and she responded to them that she couldn't hear them, and they left. She knew these individuals were in the dorm, and I think that's a kind of a telling point as well. It didn't strike her that they were uninvited people in this dorm. They weren't 50-year-old men. They weren't people who didn't look to be College Carthage students. As you pointed out earlier, Judge, they were wearing either a hat or a sweatshirt that said something about either Carthage football or Carthage athletics. So they looked to be the part of being there. After they came into her room, she did not close her door and lock the deadbolt. She left her door open. And that's what happened then, is that they came back a second time and the assault occurred then. So it's that causation issue, though, that really tells everything, and that's because, you know, these individuals also could have been guests of another resident. Other residents were allowed to bring guests into the dormitory, and so they could have been there in that regard. So to go to a jury and say, oh, it was the lack of this prop alarm on a door downstairs that may or may not have ever been open on the night, pure speculation. And I think the district court was absolutely correct in taking that pure speculation away from the jury and issuing summary judgment on that.
With regard to guests and people that aren't students but are guests, do they sign in, or is there some method of identifying those people?
They are not required to sign in.
They just come in. If one of the women in the dorm has a couple of guests, they can come in unidentified.
Correct. And I think, you know, the question itself is a very important one, and it kind of goes back to what Dr. Kennedy's testimony was. When Dr. Kennedy first tried to offer all of his expert opinions, he wanted to have all kinds of opinions about all different kinds of things. And as you properly pointed out earlier, the recommendations from the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Agencies, they're recommendations, they are not standards. It's a long list of things. And at the very end of it, it says, please be aware these are not standards. These are mere recommendations that need to be looked at in terms of your own particular needs and circumstances on your campus. So that's the problem that Dr. Kennedy ran into. He wanted to offer all these opinions. He didn't have a basis for reaching a lot of those opinions. This court recognized that he could offer an opinion on the lack of the prop alarm, but not as to anything else. And so there wasn't negligence on other issues. There's nothing to show that there was negligence on whether you need to have somebody check in when they come into the building if you're a guest of someone else. There's no negligence like that in the record at all. The only negligence that the plaintiff was going to be able to get to the jury in front of was the lack of this prop alarm. And hence, the issue of cause relates solely to that issue of the lack of the prop alarm. The plaintiff argues in her reply brief, and she does it on a number of different pages, where she wants to say that Mirko, the case that we cited in regard to the cause issue about speculation, really isn't on point and that it's really controlled by the Peters decision. Peters was not a cause case. It had nothing to do with causation. It was a standard of care case. And so the appellant's attempt to kind of deflect this case over towards Peters instead of the Mirko case doesn't carry the weight and doesn't carry the day. I think for all of those reasons, this court is presented with an issue of, did the district court err in regard to concluding that causation in this case was pure speculation? And I think it's solid that that was not an error of law, and that as a matter of law, there was nothing in this record other than speculation on the issue of causation. I, too, will surrender my time. I don't want to belabor the points with the court. It's a causation issue, and there's no cause in this case, and I believe the district court's opinion and decision should be upheld. Unless there's other questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Stadler. Anything further, Ms. Tindall?
Just a couple points. In terms of the tradition of the open door policy, Brad Andrews of Carthage testified that they were quite aware of the open door policy and encouraged students to keep their doors open because he said it was those late night conversations, which is a quote, late night conversations that really encouraged the community spirit and the exploration that they wanted with the college kids. And that's why Ms. Lees had her door open for that reason. In terms of the causation issue, the two cases that are most important to look at are Peters and Ellinger. Although Peters did deal primarily with the standard of care, the trial court in that case dismissed the case on summary judgment for the same reason we're here, lack of causation. And in that case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that had there been adequate security measures, it may have provided deterrence. And deterring crime and preventing crime was part of the reason for these security measures, not simply deterring this particular crime, but deterring crime in general. In Ellinger, the court talked about the fact that if the harm that occurs is the type that the measures you argued should have been taken were designed to prevent, then causation can be met by that type of testimony, and we contend that we have met that here. And I would point out that, you know, in essence, Carthage has conceded that perimeter security is required on its campus by installing the locks that it installed and installing the card swipe readers and the prop alarms on every door other than this particular door. So given Carthage's own concession, in essence, that it requires perimeter security and its failure to keep the perimeter secure, it's our contention we have indeed shown causation here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.